Okay, so week number one of our brand new series, and the title of it, I know, and I'm a little uncomfortable, the title is called Chaos is Coming. And considering that we just had an election, that's not a political statement of any kind. I actually got this sermon 2 weeks ago, before we knew what was going to happen in the political election, and it happened in a very weird way for me, because I think I've said this before, I believe that God speaks to us in a way specific to us and continually speaks to us that way, so we know it's Him. And I find comfort in that because that means He's not trying to speak to me in ways that I don't understand, like, for instance, dreams. I'm very comforted by the fact that God has never spoken to me in a dream because I have weird dreams. You know, there's times I wake up and I go, man, what was that about? Martha Stewart was in it and she had a Tupperware and frogs jumped out. I don't know what that was, God. You know, I just like weird dreams. And that's right, you don't speak to me in dreams. Hallelujah. And I'll go back to sleep, you know. But I may have to revise that. Because a couple weeks ago I had this experience where I'm asleep and dreaming, but I think I'm awake. You've had those, I'm sure. And in my dream, I'm preaching, not too weird so far, but I'm in the Chase the Lion series, and in my dream I'm preaching about David. Not too weird again, I've done that. But when I finish this sermon, I get up and I walk down there and someone starts talking to me, and it kind of gets a little heated for some reason. I don't know who it was or what we're saying, but all of a sudden everything snaps into focus and I hear myself say to them this. I said, well, sometimes we're not anointed king like David. Sometimes we have to find our way like Esther. And I woke up and I went, wow, that's interesting. I wonder if it's true. And so I did something that I've done not more than once. I picked my phone up and I sent myself a text message because I'll never remember this in the morning, you know. And so I sent myself a text message with that on it so I could remember this. It's still on my phone. And so I put it there and I went back to sleep. In the morning I woke up and I thought, huh, I wonder if that is true. I looked it up. That's really kind of intriguing. And I looked it up and guess what? It's true. And the thing about it that really amazed me in my life, I cannot remember hearing a sermon about Esther, ever. I don't think my dad, you know, it's like I grew up as a preacher's kid, I don't think he ever preached on Esther that I can remember. When I moved to Texas, we belonged to Gateway Church. I listened to Robert Morris, who's a great preacher, but I don't think he's ever preached about Esther. There's no one that I know has done a series on Esther, you know, maybe a stray verse here or there. And of course, I was a preacher's kid. I grew up in Vacation Bible School. I know the flannelgram version of Esther. You know, I mean, I know the basic story, but I didn't know the nuances of it. I didn't know the details of it. And so I just felt challenged by God when this happened to go find out. And I found out that this is absolutely true. And so I thought, I told Victoria, I said, I have my next series. And it's a little uncomfortable because I know nothing about it, but that never stops me. So I start studying about Esther. You know, I get books and I start, it's very hard to find sermons. You know, actually you can find the same sermon, about five different preachers preach the same sermon. Thank you, sermoncentral.com. But I saw one, but I didn't, there was only like a couple guys who've actually preached a series on it. Not many, not the who's who's you'd expect. So why is that? Well, what I discovered was the Christian church has always had a problem with the book of Esther. It really has from the very beginning of the Protestant Reformation. In fact, it predates that, but John Calvin, who wrote Calvin's Institutes, I'm getting a little bit into history today. Some of you like that, but most of you don't. Bear with me. But John Calvin, who wrote Calvin's Institutes, which is the kind of foundational theology of the Baptist Church and the Presbyterian Church, has absolutely nothing in his commentaries about Esther at all. He mentions it just briefly on one page for one paragraph in his Institutes. That's it. Martin Luther, you know, the famed Reformationist, didn't even think it should be in the Bible. He said, man, I wish we didn't even have the book of Esther in a Bible. It shouldn't even be there. You look at that, and I'm like, man, what is this? The Catholic Church disliked the story of Esther so much, they changed it. So if you read the early books from the Catholic and Greek Orthodox, they've changed it. They've added things to the story of Esther to make it fit. And but if you look at the real book of text, Esther, the text that we have, the Christian church is really just kind of ignoring it because it's a little bit embarrassing. Here's what's really strange, though. Jews love it. The Jewish people love the story of Esther. In fact, they still celebrate the Feast of Esther over 2,000 years later. And it's one of the few feasts, one of the two feasts that is not ordained in the book of Leviticus. They've added this one. And they still hold it every year. And here's, I thought was interesting. This year, it's going to be held on March 11th. So remember that date. We might have to have a Feast of Esther on March 11th, those of us who are together. So that's it. In fact, one of the early rabbis said this, when the Messiah comes, and okay, he's a rabbi, so he doesn't know he came, but watch what he says. He says, the other Hebrew books might pass away, but the Torah, that's the first five books of the Bible, and Esther will abide forever. This is a very well-respected Jewish rabbi and teacher who has basically said, Esther's more important than the book of Psalms. It's more important than the story of David in 1 and 2 Samuel. It's more important than Isaiah. That's a remarkable thing, considering that Christendom has completely dismissed Esther. Why? Why is Christians so against it? Well, there's a problem with the book of Esther. It never mentions God once. And I'm not just talking about it doesn't have his name in it, Jehovah. It never mentions that a person, a being named God exists. There's no prophecy. There are no dreams. There's no mention of prayer. There's no mention of Jewish law or commandments. So you can understand why this is a very odd book. In fact, it's weird that Hollywood hasn't jumped onto it more. You know, here's a perfect biblical book that they could have with no God in it. It seems like they're always trying to yank God out of our biblical books when they make a movie about it. Here's one that's there. They could just take it, but they don't. You know, so it's very strange. And so you look at that and say, well, what's going on here? This whole book could be written without this. And how is that the story that belongs in the Bible? You know, it's almost like an Aesop fable at this point. Why would you have this in the Bible at all? Well, Charles Spurgeon, God bless him, an early pastor of this century, had a quote that I really liked about it. He says, look, sometimes somebody paints a painting or makes a drawing about somebody, and it's so bad, they have to put the name on it to let you know who it is. Like, have you seen a fifth grader draw Mom? You know, if it weren't for the fact it said Mom on the bottom of it, that purple blob of crayon with black hair would not look like Mom. You wouldn't know that was Mom. But he said, sometimes somebody does such an artful job with a portrait that you don't need their name to know who it is. And that's the book of Esther. If you look at Esther, God's fingerprints are all over it, even though he's never mentioned. And it's really kind of an encouraging book, because I think that most of us are a lot more like Esther than we are like David. I don't think many of us have been anointed by the apostle or the prophet of God and been called to some great thing in life. You know, I don't think many of us have had that calling in our life from birth. I don't think there's many of us that could say, well, God's prophetically spoke to me and this happened. I think most of us are a lot more like Esther. We're trying to get along in the world without any kind of great revelation from God. We want to know that we're pleasing him. We want to do something for him. But sometimes we're really not sure if we're doing it right. You know, is God in my life or not? And if I'm going to be honest, I don't even know. And a lot of people have told me that in the Chase of Lions series. Boy, it's a great series. I wish I had some great dream given to me by God, because I don't seem to have that. You know, I don't seem to have that in my life. I have this belief in God without this great moment of God, and that's the book of Esther. So if that's you, congratulations. You're going to love this series, because we're going to talk about somebody who kind of lived their life at least ostensibly that God never spoke to. Now, I don't actually believe that. I believe God did. And I'll get in that when we get the history of this. But to me, the book of Esther kind of brought back something that my father said once. And he said, look, God's hands are always working in our lives. But usually they're moving too fast for us to see. And yet occasionally, he'll let one linger long enough for us to catch a glimpse. I think that's kind of the book of Esther. I think that his hands are moving, and every now in the book of Esther, you'll see he lingers long enough that we can just catch a glimpse of it, and we know that was God, okay? So that's what we're going to be talking about. Now, I'm going to be talking about this throughout this as though God isn't in it, even though I'm believing God is. Now, a little bit of history about Esther before we get into the Bible's history. We don't know who wrote it. The first document that we found of it was actually an ancient Greek document found in the library of Alexander the Great, which, by the way, tells us how important it was at the time historically, because they took the time to copy it from Persia, where originally they reference it, the Persian library. They took the time to copy it into the Greek library. So this was a very, very important historical text as far as everybody at the time believed. It tells you how important it is. And so we don't have the original, and we don't really know who wrote it or when it was written. There's a lot of different theories. I read a lot of doctorate thesis on early Persian archaeology finds. It's dry reading, let me tell you. But after reading a lot of it, I believe that, I didn't come up with this myself, somebody else suggests this, I believe this is right. The author of it is writing as though it's past tense. You know, this isn't a Twitter account of what happened. This is past tense. But still with enough intimate knowledge of the inner workings of the Persian Empire and their ruling class, that they had to have some really firsthand information. So this probably wasn't something written 500, 600 years later. It was probably written pretty much contemporary to when Esther lived, and they wrote it. Now, here's what I believe. I believe the reason that God's name never appears is because the author wanted the story of Esther to remain. And I believe they wrote it during the Persian Empire still, when it was the big Persian, the empire of the world. And I believe they knew that it had to be put into the Persian library if it was going to last. And I think they deliberately left all the God stuff out, because if the Persian people knew that the great King Xerxes was a puppet of the living God, they would never accept the story. So I believe he deliberately left it out, but you can almost see the author winking at us occasionally in Western. You know what really happened here, right? And so I believe they did it. I believe this was probably done as a eulogy for Esther somewhere around the occasion of her death. But that's just a gut feeling and guess. Nobody really knows. Okay, so let me tell you now about what the Bible tells us. Okay, so these events happened in the days, and this king is the guy we know as Xerxes. So I'm going to use Xerxes. And if I had preached this sermon 20 years ago, I might have to explain to you all who Xerxes was. But we've had two movies come out in the last decade that kind of explains who Xerxes is. It's 300 and 300 Rise of the Empire. This is that guy. This is the guy who eventually face off against King Leonidas in the Battle of Thermopylae and the Hot Gates and the 300 Spartans. This is that king. And Esther starts just a little bit before that happens. So kind of put it into your context of history. But at the time, King Xerxes reigned over 127 provinces. Let me give you a picture of the Persian map. It was huge. Or as President Eck would say, huge. It was huge. It was very, very big. It stretched all across. It was the largest empire of its kind at the time. It had surpassed Egyptian's empire. It had surpassed Babylonian's. And it wouldn't be surpassed again until Alexander the Great. It was a very, very large empire. He was a very, very rich ruler. And it stretched all across, all the way up to the Balkans, had all of Egypt into Africa. It was an amazing empire that Xerxes held over. So in the third year of his reign, he decides to have this huge banquet for all of his princes and attendants and the army officers and the nobles, basically the money in his and money in the high-ranking officials. He had this huge thing, and it went on for 180 days, where he's just like bringing forth all the glory of his empire. Now, he has a reason for this, by the way. There's a purpose. As he's bringing all this stuff in to show him, they would have like a whole day for, here's the Egyptian culture that we've conquered. Here's the Jewish culture we conquered. And they would bring them in one by one. They'd have the food, and they'd have dancers, and they'd display the wealth, right? So they're doing this. The reason he's doing this is because he's getting ready to march on Greece, and he knows this is not going to be a walk in the park. Because unlike some of the other places they conquered, Greece has a standing army, and they're good. And he knows that. And so he's trying to kind of rah-rah up the patriotism of Persia and get everybody excited about what he's going to do. I'm going to go march on after Greece. And so that's what he's doing. So then when it's all done, he has his banquet lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in the citadel. Again, this is the who's who. This is the rich nobles. This is the Game of Thrones thing where all the rich people come together. Right? This is only them. And drinks were served in golden vessels. And the Bible specifically tells us, basically, that the wine and all liquor, basically all alcohol, flowed freely. In fact, the king gave his steward instructions that there was no rules on drinking. They could have whatever they want, as much as they wanted, for 7 straight days. Now, I don't know if any of you have had the privilege of being in a room with a bunch of guys that are drinking freely. But I've heard rumors, me personally, never been there, but I've heard that things get pretty wild sometimes. They get drunk and the testosterone flows as freely as the wine, and everybody starts doing one-upmanship and things. And so finally the king gets caught up in this as well, and he decides to one-up them all because, he is the king. So on the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded his eunuchs to go bring his queen to display before the court. Now, the Persian king would have had a lot of concubines, but he would have one that he called the queen consort. He might have multiple wives, but the one would be the queen consort. She's the one who basically was his trophy queen. She was the one who would sit beside him on the throne. She was the one who'd be in the parades with him. She was his trophy that he would show off. So what he's doing here is a little bit weird to us, but it was kind of her job, is to be the trophy. So he says he's supposed to bring her in a royal crown, and he's going to display her beauty to the people, for she was very beautiful. So he sends for her. Oh, you think you guys got something? Wait for this. Now, this she would have been picked out of the entire Persian Empire, so she would have been astonishingly beautiful, and he's just going to show off his trophy. But Queen Vashti was her name, refused to come to the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. This is amazing, by the way. Nobody refused the king Xerxes. And this was, again, kind of her job. And this moment in the story kind of starts causing some problems for theologians, because no one knows why she said no. It almost doesn't make sense. Some people believe, and there's a lot of people come forth kind of with this, she's the first feminist of the Bible. She goes, no, I'm not going to do it. You know, I'm just a fragile, delicate flower, and I ain't coming. You know, you can't do this to me. You're not going to make me display before all of your boys. I'm not playing your silly little game, Xerxes. Probably not, by the way, because we can kind of predict how Xerxes is going to react to that. And he's a guy who has all ultimate power, and if he actually decides he's going to react with a tantrum, you're dead. So probably wasn't it. There's a lot of different theories as to why she said no. One theory is that God had afflicted her with some skin problem, boils or, you know, some kind of hives or something. And she couldn't tell him that because, you know, that freaks people out when they have skin problems. Who knows? And you could get banished for that. But she couldn't come either. And so she was kind of caught in there, so she couldn't tell him why she couldn't come. But she couldn't come and be displayed right now because she was covered with something. That's not so far-fetched, because Queen Vashti, by the way, was well known to be a beautiful but cruel person, especially to Jewish girls. She would humiliate her Jewish servants. There's actually a kind of a gazette of the day that's been found in the Persian Empire that talked about how she liked to humiliate especially her Jewish servants. So maybe God struck her with something. Sounds like it. God's moving behind the scenes here. He's setting this whole thing up. So it sounds very much like something he might have done, but we don't know why. We only know she said no, and then predictably, the king became very angry and his wrath burned within him. Now, the writer of Esther here starts having some fun with what happens next, because the scene he paints is pretty ridiculous. Here's the mighty King Xerxes, you know, and he's angry, and then he goes into a room with his boys. You know, he goes, leaves, and they start whispering amongst themselves. And so he says to the wise men who understood the times, for it was the custom of the king to so speak before all who knew the law and justice. And I just think Esther's writer here is having some fun, because you're going to see this is no way to run an empire. You know, this is just kind of ridiculous. He's saying, what should we do to Vashti? You know, I'm really mad. He goes in there, what can we do? What can we do? What should we do? And he's actually asking his boys, you know, what should I do about this? Now, understand what's happened is not just that she hasn't come and displayed herself. She said no to the king, and he's embarrassed by this. He's humiliated. His own wife said no to him. You know, how am I going to march against the Greece when my own wife won't even, you know, obey my commands? How's an army going to do it? So he's worried this might get out. And so one of his guys steps up, a guy named Memucan, who says, look, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also the princes and all the people. Like, hey, this is a problem. We are having a problem here on major proportions, because when it becomes known that the queen got away with this, all wives will look with contempt on their husbands and saying, Queen Vashti did not have to obey. And all the ladies of Persia will speak the same way to all their men, which means my wife's going to say it to me. You know, and we're worried about this. And there will be much contempt and anger. These guys are scared to death of the women in their lives. This is really kind of funny. You know, these are the big, you know, strong guys and everything else. But they're scared to death of the women. You know, oh boy. If the women hear about it, there's no telling where this might end. You know, it might not end well. And so, you know, we need to stop this. We need to somehow nip this in the bud right now, because this could just ruin everything if women know they can say no to the men. So they came up with this idea, let an edict be issued and written into the laws of Persia, so it cannot be changed. That's a funny line, by the way, that shows up cannot be changed. Of course, it could be changed, but this is the way the Persian king thinks. That Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Xerxes. This is pretty funny because if you think about it, he was worried that someone might find out what Vashti did. So what we're going to do is we're going to write in an edict and send it to all the empire so everybody hears about what she did. And then her punishment for not coming to see the king is she can't come to see the king. It's like, you can't quit, you're fired. This is kind of really silly. But he does it. He thinks, okay, let's do that. So he passes this edict, and they banished Vashti, and she's never really heard of again, although she does give an heir to the throne later. So she disappears, and, I showed her. And then reality sets in about the time he sobers up, and he realizes, my bed's empty now. I just banished the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, and I'm kind of missing her right about now. And now that I'm sober, I kind of think I made a mistake. This was maybe not my best thought. She was gorgeous, and by the way, she'd been raised to serve the king, so she was talented, and now she's gone. And I'm kind of missing her, but that's okay. His boys have a thought. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to gather up. Vashti was beautiful, no doubt, but there are a lot of beautiful women in your empire. Let's go gather them all up, and you can pick from all of them, that will be the final one that you pick, and she'll become your queen. So basically, we're talking about the Bachelor Persia, So this is what it is. Of course, the Bachelor is no good unless it's introduced by Chris Harrison telling us why it's the most dramatic episode ever.
It's the most dramatic season yet, because this time, everyone dies.
Maybe not, but it's possible, and we're talking about Xerxes here, right? I mean, anything's possible here, and I'm a little bit embarrassed to even know who Chris Harrison is, but I do. So anyway, so that's what they're going to do. They're going to set up this big beauty contest, and the last one he gives the rose to gets to be the queen consort. The problem is that there were a couple things that could happen to you when you're brought before the king. He might like you and stick you in his concubines, which means you're part of his harem, which isn't a great life. I mean, you're taken care of, but you'll never ever have a family. You'll never have a husband. That's one thing could happen. He could be displeased with you and kill you. Everyone dies. It's very possible if you blow it that you're going to be sentenced to death. You could be sent home in disgrace, but probably you'd just be killed. Or you could end up being the queen consort. So, there's thousands of things that can go wrong and one thing that can go right. So you would think that this would not necessarily be something that every girl was aspiring to. I don't know, they're all lining up to get in a stretch limos, to go before the king. So this is what happens. Now at this moment, the Bible shifts gears. And it finally, we're already into Esther chapter 2, as far as we go. And they're finally going to introduce Esther to us. So far, they haven't. So they do. And so there was in Susa, which is where this was, a Jew whose name was Mordecai. He was a descendant of Kish. Stick a pin in that. We're coming back to that in a couple weeks. And he was bringing up Hadassah. Now, Hadassah is the Jewish name for Esther. This Jewish name means myrtle. And I know that's not a very sexy name, Myrtle. You think of I have a great aunt, Myrtle. You don't think I have a sexy hot wife, Myrtle, all right? But the myrtle tree was actually a very important tree in Jewish culture. If you read in Isaiah 55, the prophet says that this is how you'll know, this is one of the signs from God that he hasn't deserted you, when you see the myrtle tree bloom. Just like the rainbow was a sign that he gave to Noah. In Isaiah, the myrtle tree is a sign that God has not forsaken you. So this is interesting. He raises up someone named Myrtle in order to show them that he has not forsaken them. Because, the Jewish empire has been conquered in Jerusalem, and they're part of the Persian empire now. So it's a very important name. But she was called Esther in Persia, and that was his niece. It's kind of a loose niece. It was kind of a distant cousin. Now, in those days, that's a big deal because her father and her mother had both died. And when you're an orphan in normal times, it's a bad deal. It's really a bad deal when you're in a conquered orphan. A lot of those just die. They die in the streets, or they end up doing horrible things to survive. That was kind of her path, but Mordecai steps in and adopts her as his own daughter. Which, by the way, hardly ever happens in the Bible. Three times does somebody adopt somebody. And this is one of them. He actually takes her and adopts her as his own daughter. Now, the Bible also tells us, takes a moment to say, the young lady was beautiful of form and face. So this is the Bible's very discreet way of saying she wasn't only just beautiful to look at, She was hot. You know, she had a great body. She had it all going on here. She was beautiful in form and face, and she's probably about 15 years old. I love the movies that always show her 30. She's probably about 15 at this point. So she was must have been some kind of a looker, though, because she was Jewish, and she wouldn't have been part of the main area, and she would have been kind of off a little bit. And yet they knew of her beauty, because they go sweeping through the countryside finding beautiful people, and they knew about her. And we see right here that they actually say Esther was taken, and the word there taken means almost like abducted. So, you know, they came knocking the door, we hear you have a beautiful girl, haha, that's her, they grab her and they take her. So I want you to kind of think about Esther for a moment, because this is her life. You know, her parents died, and she was going to be destitute. You know, she had the good fortune of her cousin adopting her into his household and going to raise her as a daughter. She barely gets to know him before the Persian army comes sweeping through, grabbing her at spear point, yanking her out. We're going to take you for this big beauty contest to the king of Persia. And so she's taken there. And so you can kind of feel for her. You know, she's disoriented. And this is what I'm talking about. Chaos is coming. Her life has always been a bit chaotic since her parents died, and it's not getting any better now. She wouldn't have seen this as a good thing. This was a horrible thing. She's taken from the one man who was actually trying to love her like her daughter and teach her, and yanked out of that home, and now we're going to go to the palace. She has no idea what she's doing there. Not like she was raised to be in the palace, right? So she's kind of thrown into this area that she does not understand. So let's feel a little sorry for her for a moment, because that's really not an easy thing for her to be put into. But she gets placed in the custody of Haggai, the eunuch, who was in charge of the women. Okay, so one thing, though, the Bible says she did not let anyone know she was Jewish. So that was a secret that she kept, and she kept it because Mordecai, probably she's being yanked from him, you know, said, don't tell anybody. And you can understand why, because they knew that, for instance, Vashti was very cruel to Jews, and, you know, they don't know what happened to Vashti. She could be coming back. So you can understand why they want to keep that a little bit of a secret. So she goes off to the palace. Now, it wasn't just, you know, we scrub them up, put them on a dress, and throw them in front of Xerxes. That's not how it works. They had to prepare them to go see the king. You know, they worshiped Xerxes like a god, so they had to prepare them. So each young woman's turn came to go into Xerxes after she completed 12 months of preparation, according to regulations. 6 months for oil and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying the women. Now, this would not have just been oil and perfume, because it doesn't take you 6 months to put oil or perfume on. This actually was kind of, again, a euphemism over the training she would have gone through in order to learn how to serve the king. And you're just going to put somebody in there. They have to know how to talk, how to stand, how to dance, how to serve him food, and other things, right? So they're going to teach her everything she needs to know in order to be a good, loyal wife to King Xerxes. It takes 12 months. And, of course, most of the women are resisting most of this, unless they're grown-up Persian. Maybe they wanted the honor, but most of the Jews and some of the other cultures, this would be horrifying. And, by the way, according to Jewish law, it should be horrifying. She's not allowed to marry somebody who's not Jewish, let alone be touched by a Gentile. So, you know, she's being put in a very, very difficult situation here. So let's talk now about the problem of Esther. And, you know, so far I just feel sorry for Esther. You know, I read this story, and so, man, why are Christians so against her? Well, the reason Christianity comes so much against Esther is because she isn't this guy. See, Daniel's kind of the gold standard of this, because he had a very similar situation happen to him. A couple years ago, we did the Survivor series all about Daniel. And so some of us know the story of Daniel. And Daniel's preached much more, by the way, than Esther. And the reason is because Daniel does everything right. And we see, by the way, that his situation is not too different from hers. Jerusalem falls, and the king of Babylon, who conquered it, Nebuchadnezzar, takes the people off. But look why he picked them. They were youths in whom was no defect. They were good looking. So it was a bit of a beauty contest there too. But they also had to show some intelligence, and they had some understanding, because they were going to serve in a court. By the way, Esther had some intelligence and understanding as well. So they were kind of picked for the same reasons. And they go in the very same way into a foreign court. And they both had a very rough trip getting there. You know, Daniel was thrown into a back of a little tiny wagon with a bunch of other guys and taken away. They didn't know what was going to happen to them. This is the victory parade of Babylon. And same thing happens to her. She gets picked up and taken. They didn't want to go, but they had to go. They suddenly find themselves in the court of a foreign king. And they're expected to learn how to go. And they're even taught, they're going to be taught for 3 years, these guys, in order to know how to do it. The king appoints them a daily ration from their choice food and from the wine, and they'll be educated for 3 years. So, you know, Esther had a year of it. Daniel was going to have 3 years of it. We're going to teach you how to think and talk like a Babylonian. And we're going to change you into a Babylonian, in fact. And that's why we're going to give you food from the king's table, to show you we're generous and grateful. And we're going to be gracious to you. We're going to give you all this great food and all this wine. And you can just, you've never had food like this, because this is the best. And after it's all done, we're going to put you into personal service of the king. This is a good thing that's happening to you. Everybody around Daniel sighing a breath of relief at this point. Oh, good. We're not being killed. Look at this. We're going to eat like kings. This is going to be absolutely great. And the Bible tells us that there were four people the book of Daniel is going to follow. Daniel himself, and then Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And we know these last three guys as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And we know Daniel as Daniel. But that's not what they called him in Babylon. They called him Belteshazzar. It's interesting, though, that it isn't the book of Belteshazzar, is it? It's the book of Daniel. But it's the book of Esther. And so we start seeing some of the differences start showing up here, because Daniel never ever compromised who he was. In fact, Daniel made up his mind he was not going to defile himself with the king's food. So he was brought before the court, and he was given the opportunity to eat all the food and all the wine, and everybody else is, you know, jumping to the table. This is great. And he's saying, I'm not going to do that. And he goes and he seeks permission of the commander of the officials that he will not defile himself, because that violates Jewish law. And here's what I know. I am who the living God says I am. You can call me Belteshazzar if you want, but I'm Daniel. And you can try to tell me I'm a Babylonian now, but I'm not. I am Jewish. I am his chosen people. I am who the living God says I am. And he would not compromise that from day one. He steps out of the cart. And believe me, there were people who looked at him like he was nuts. Esther thought she was who other people said she was. In the beginning of the book of Esther, we see that's all she thinks she is. She let other people define him. But I actually find some comfort in that, because she isn't heroic at first. She's not. But there's a lot of people who aren't heroic at first in the Bible. Joseph wasn't. Even David certainly had his moments. He wasn't very heroic. And so I get some comfort in the fact that he has picked Esther to do something amazing for his people, and she kind of screws up to start off by compromising everything she believes. She even hides her identity because she's afraid of what they'll do to her if she finds out. But here's the good news. Your poor performance cannot derail God's purpose. And that's, I personally find some real comfort in that, because I screw up too. You know, I'm a lot more like Esther than I am Daniel. And so I'm comforted by the fact that even though I screwed up, doesn't mean that God's plan is ruined now. But we see that both of them have something really interesting happen to them, because she finds favor with Haggai. And he provides her with cosmetics and foods and her own servants. He actually sets her up. He loves her so much because she just throws herself into this. She doesn't give him any lip. She doesn't protest. She just does the best she can. She learns and she performs as well as she can. And he loves her for it. And he actually sets her up with her own special place and gives her special advice. She finds favor with Haggai. Well, that's not so different from what happens with Daniel. Even though he's being a thorn on this guy's side, even though he's saying, oh, wait a minute, I'm not doing this. And you would think the guy would hate him. Instead, he finds favor with him. In fact, the guy comes to Daniel and says, Daniel, listen, I'm feeling for you, buddy. I understand. But I can't give you what you're asking for. Because Daniel said, I basically want to eat food I raise myself out of the garden. I pluck the food out of the garden and the water I get from the well myself. He doesn't want anything mixed in. He wants it pure. He says, if you just have vegetables and water, you're going to look horrible in about 10 days. And when the king comes in to see how you're all doing, everybody else is going to be doing great, and you're going to look horrible. And guess whose head's getting chopped off at that point? So although I'd like to help you here, I can't. And so Daniel says this, okay, let's try it. Let's try it for 10 days. And if in 10 days what you're saying is true, I'll go back and I'll eat this food. Give me a chance to prove to you it won't. And God performs a miracle right there, because the commander's right. That's what they, I don't know if I've ever seen anybody go on a vegan diet. And I know everybody tells us they're great, and all, I'm not going to get into that. But except to say, again, if I'm supposed to be a vegetarian, God put the wrong teeth in my mouth because he put canines in my mouth, but it's made for ripping and tearing meat. But aside from that, even the people who go on a vegan diet will tell you it starts off horrible. You know, until the body adjusts to it, it's awful. And instead, from day one, Daniel just starts, you know, perfect health. And his three buddies, same thing. God performs a miracle in their lives, and so he finds favor with the commander. So it doesn't matter one compromises and one doesn't. What matters is God's favor. But God will perform a favor. But listen, we think that favor of God is like he did me a favor. It's great I can have God do me favors. God can have a new car. Show me your favor. Give me a new car. Could use a better house right now, God. Give me that. So do me a favor. You know, do me a solid, God. Come on, help me out here. That's not what favor means. When it's saying you find God's favor, which is what this was. It was God's favor, you know, distributed through earth. The favor of God is the guarantee of his presence and the provision of his power to accomplish his purpose in and through your life. That's God's favor. There's a purpose here. He has you set aside for a purpose. He had Daniel set aside for a purpose. He had Esther set aside for a purpose. And guess what? He has you set aside for a purpose too. In order to accomplish that, you need his favor. And he'll do that. Okay, so a couple quick things and we're done. Surviving chaos. So chaos is coming. How do you survive it? It's counterintuitive. The way we survive chaos, first step is you bring God in. And the reason I say that's counterintuitive is because most people don't do it. When people get in trouble, they pull away from church and they pull away from God. I see it happen. We've only been in business here for 3 years now. I've seen it happen so much. I'm working on some stuff right now. I'll come to church later. I got to get this done. Right? I lost my job, or I just got promoted. I got some stuff that's causing chaos in my life right now. I'm going to take care of it, and boy, I'll be back as soon as I take care of it. But we basically say there's chaos going on in my life, and the last thing I need right now is God. Listen, the first thing you need right now is God. He's really good with chaos. He created the world out of chaos. He's good at it, okay? He really knows how to deal in chaos. And he's the best person in the world dealing in chaos. Why wouldn't you want him in your life? We need to run to God, not run away from him, not give him a stiff arm, stay away. We don't want to do that. Second of all, when chaos hit, remember who you are. Don't let somebody else define you. Remember who you are. Daniel said, you know what? I'm a chosen one of the king. And this is what Paul says in Romans. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God. And if children, heirs, and heirs of, and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, we also are going to be glorified with him. So what he's saying is, you're a child of God. If you're suffering, don't worry. He's got a way of working us into glory. But we have to remember who we are. And then when we remember who we are, we need to act like it. So many Christians just simply don't act like Christians in the moments of crisis. Somebody said, you know, if you have a bucket and it's full of acid and someone kicks it, the acid falls out. And you may blame the kick, but if the acid wasn't in there, it wouldn't be falling out. It's real simple, right? When your bucket gets kicked, what comes out? I guess is another way of putting it. When your life gets thrown in turmoil and they take your life into this, what's spilling out? Because if it's acid, we're not acting like the children of God. And we see this in Proverbs 3. He says this, my son, don't forget my teaching. Let your heart keep my commandments. For the length of days and years of life and peace, they will add to you. Write them on the tablet of your heart, so you will find favor. He says, you want God's favor in chaos? Which, by the way, you need God's favor in chaos. Here's how you do it. You remember my commandments. You don't stop. You don't change. You are who you are. Continue being who I made you to be. Continue following the instructions I've given you. That's how you get my favor. If I enter in your situation and I bring favor, your situation's gone. Everything's better. But if you keep trying to do it on your own, stiffing arm God, and I'm going to manipulate this and make it myself, then God says, okay, go ahead. I don't know if anybody saw the quote that I put up this past week on the Spirit Chapel's Facebook page from C.S. Lewis. He said, basically, there's two kinds of people in the world. Those that say, thy will be done, and those to whom God says, okay, have it your way. That's the problem. You know, the we're not willing to accept God's way. We'll say, I got it. And God, the worst thing that happened, God said, okay, you got it? show me what you got. And we screw things up. Some of my biggest problems have come because I've gotten in chaos and I've just simply, God, I got this because I'm scrambling right now. You need to take a moment. David, when his kingdom was before he was crowned king officially, when his, you know, hiding away and he's got his band of men and he's been doing all this, his kingship hangs in the balance. His own men are turned against him. They want to stone him. It's like this close to being over. And what David does is retreats to a cave and strengthens himself in the Lord. Because he says, boy, I'm going to need God right now. He doesn't scramble. He goes back and says, God, I need you right here, right now. If we don't understand that we need to bring God into our chaos, chaos will rule us. It's just that simple. God's favor for your purpose. Would you all please pray with me?